shatters the frown of the nations in the thoughts of their hearts. God takes the powerful from their thrones and lifts up the lowly. God fills the hungry with good things and sends the rich away empty.
You're listening to Faith and Reason 360. Support for this program comes from the Joe and Louise Cook Foundation, Barbara Wendland, Director, and the D.L. Dykes Jr. Foundation, promoting critical thinking and advocating for justice in the world. I'm Debo Dykes, and my host today is David Dykes. Welcome, David.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Anne has taken a little hiatus, but she'll be back with us for our next episode. Our special guest, again, this is our fourth episode in a series that is featuring Dr. Jörg Rieger, and we are discussing Jesus versus Caesar. And Dr. Rieger is the Distinguished Professor of Theology and Cal Turner Chancellor's Chair in Wesleyan Studies in the Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion at Vanderbilt University. Dr. Rieger is also director of the newly founded Program in Religion and Justice at Vanderbilt Divinity School. So, Jörg, again, welcome. And Jörg, again, for our listening audience, you grew up in Germany. My mother was a Weber. And so, although I do not speak German, my mother was very proud of her German heritage. So for our German listening audience, you want to offer a little greeting?
I guess I could do that. Anyways, first in English, let me say I'm very glad to be here, and thanks for having me, Debo and David. In German, I would say, you know, a typical greeting is Guten Tag, and you might add, ich bin sehr froh, heute hier zu sein. I'm happy to be here today.
Oh, so well said. Thank you so much, Jörg. Well, I want to start with crucifixion. And that is central to especially the Christian tradition. And crucifixion, you mentioned in your book, was not a rare event. And that that mass crucifixions you mentioned occurred all of the time. And so I want to talk a little bit about the crucifixion of Jesus, who crucified Jesus, and then what is important about the crucifixion of Jesus.
So thanks for that question, Debo. What we've been talking about in this series is how religion is always related to life. So you cannot separate religion and politics, religion and economics. And when you talk about important moments in the life of faith, and crucifixion is one, you always have to ask the question, how do these things go together? So people who think about the crucifixion without looking at how it's placed in actual life, without how it's, you know, affecting various relationships, they're probably going to miss the point. One thing that we've learned over the years, and this is not just my thinking, but we find this in other theologians as well, is that we have to ask questions as to who is interested in what. So one question would be, who might have been interested in seeing Jesus end up on the cross? And you cannot say it was nobody. I mean, there were some people that were worried about Jesus and Jesus' ministry. Now, very oftentimes, people still think this was Jewish people who were interested in having Jesus killed. That's not quite the case. There were some Jewish people who wanted to get rid of Jesus. It wasn't all Jews. It was some power brokers. It was some people that felt there was a challenge. It was the elites. And the same is true for the Romans. It wasn't all Romans that wanted to see Jesus end up on the cross, but it was the powerful groups that felt challenged, not only by Jesus, what Jesus was saying, but also by what Jesus was doing. We talked about Jesus being an organizer, and building power that's different from the power of the empire is always a challenge. And so there is some consensus today that this all has to be considered when we think about why Jesus was put to the cross.
You also mentioned that it turns out that the cross is not to be necessarily viewed as a defeat. You mentioned that, like a trauma, that the cross could turn out to be a source of energy of resistance. So say, do you have anything you can offer to that?
And of course, this is something that theologians have talked about a lot, but the inspiration for that really came from the life of people. So in Latin American liberation theology, for instance, you know, this is a theology that began in the late 60s, early 70s. There was some understanding that, you know, crucified is not just Jesus, but people with him. And so Latin American theologians talked about the crucified people. By that, they meant people that were actually killed in all the expressions of empire in Latin America in those days. But those theologians also realized that you could not really kill the people altogether. You could not really get rid of that which cannot be killed. You could not really get rid of the resistance and the alternatives. And so there's sort of a very broad, mundane way, perhaps, of talking about how the cross turns into resistance. But you see some of that in Jesus also, that Jesus's followers, in some ways, you know, at first they're scattered, they're afraid. It's only the women who are actually there. So this is another interesting conversation here. Why is it the women, and what's so important about that? I think that's very important.
Why? Why?
Yeah, because I think, well, in some ways, maybe women had more guts, you know. Women had an understanding that it wasn't so much about them or about the typical mechanisms of empire. They realized there was something bigger than themselves. And so here these women already get the courage before the resurrection. So the cross here, I mean, the resurrection is important. I don't want to downplay the importance of it. But to say the cross itself already was a moment for galvanizing some resistance and for courageous people to realize that the Roman Empire will not win, even though it won that one thing.
You know, I won't go into it, but I'm very convinced that the women got Jesus first, that the women figured out what he was talking about first.
That the women knew what Jesus
was
up
to. The women got what Jesus was up to, yeah. They already had him identified as the one to lead us before he was crucified. They were forming a community around him and he around them, I guess.
Jorg, in your book, Jesus versus Caesar, chapter 4 is titled God versus Mammon. And you start off by pointing out, which we've been talking about, life-giving religion and malignant religion, which earlier on you gave a very good explanation of what we are talking about in terms of your definition of a malignant religion. But you start this chapter off by talking about failure to understand the tensions between life-giving and malignant religion has seduced many into supporting economic systems that benefit elite minorities and regulate the vast majority of humanity and the planet to exploitation and suffering. So would you share with us a little bit about our economic systems and how we're actually doing this?
There's a long history here, and you could say, well, economic systems have oftentimes created inequality. But if you look today, we've created an inequality that's pretty unique in history. So we're not just talking about some minor faults or failures of the system. We're really talking about the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. This is something that many people talk about, and it can be backed up with data. What I'm talking about is the religious component of all of that. And if you look at economic systems, you'll realize that sometimes economic systems are defended with religious zeal and fervor. And I think this is what we're seeing in our own time, where the assumption is there is one economic system, and of course the one that we define. We might call it capitalism or neoliberal capitalism. Those are some of the technical terms. That is now defended as if this were the only option that's always available. Now, the way I define empire is basically a position where somebody wants you to believe that there is no alternative. So here we find this. And for a lot of people, the assumption is that this is our only option. Now, theologically speaking, with the passage of, Jesus saying that you cannot serve God and mammon at the same time, mm-hmm. I'm not just worried about faulty economic systems. I'm worried about a situation where the economic system has de facto become our God, and we're not able to question and to raise questions anymore because it is now at that level. You could also look from another perspective. Among economists, there is now a lot of conversation about economics as religion, where serious economists have argued that the way religion and economy function is very similar, namely believing in big things like a rising tide lifting all boats now is your dogma, and you basically act as if this was the only truth that was available. So it's those kinds of things that I'm worried about, where the problem with mammon is not simply that, you know, a lot of people or some people have more wealth than others, but this becomes our God, this becomes our religion.
Well, I had made note of your book. I think it was one of the first books that I read cover to cover that you wrote on rising tide does not lift all boats. And just a profound message in that book. And actually, I've heard that mentioned, and I always think of you when I hear someone, especially an anchor on a news network, say the rising tide does not lift all boats. And I often wonder, oh, they've read York's book. But, you talk about statistics also in chapter 4, and this is always such a staggering statistic for me. And I think it's so worth reminding people and repeating that 43% of all children live below or near poverty level. What does that mean?
In
what
the
does
United
that
States.
Translate?
In the United States.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Supposedly the wealthiest country on the earth.
And you talk about food insecure.
Let me jump in front of
Go
that.
Go right
though,
ahead.
Because it's here, Jorg, that you compare those that hold the wealth in the times of the Roman Empire, and you say that it's estimated that 1% controlled the economy of the Roman Empire, controlled 16% of all wealth, and that today in the United States, supposedly a free and democratic country, that 1% control more than 40% of all the wealth. Now, you know, we think of the Roman Empire as being rough and kind of brutal and everything, and yet we are almost three times deeper into this problem than they were in, what was it, 150 of the Common Era.
That's right.
And so then Devo points out that this has the implication of 43% of the children that live below or near the poverty line. And they talk about food insecurity, that is, not even sure if they'll have a meal before they go to sleep this particular night. So just comment on that comparison between Rome and the U.S.
So you really have to see those two figures together, because sometimes people might say, and I've heard this being said, that if there's 40% or if the 1% controls 40% of all wealth, we now have so much wealth compared to the Roman Empire that there's enough left for everybody. So you could say, you know, even if that's the case, maybe things are getting better because, you know, the bottom is sort of also lifted. That's not really true, because the number that Debo quoted says that there are so and so many children in our own country who are not benefiting from this. Now, this number of 43% children hovering around the poverty line is really dramatic, because this is not just a matter of one thing or another. This is, food insecurity is one thing. There are some people in this country who do not have enough food to eat, is what that means. But then you also have to think about the future of these children around the poverty line. Now, the American dream says that you can accomplish anything you want. The statistics tell us, though, that the American dream is not really alive and well, because social mobility in the United States is worse than in any other industrialized country around the world. And so what you're getting is the American dream not only being dead, but people are basically told things are okay when they're not okay at all.
Right.
And so putting this together, it seems like we have a tremendous crisis on our hands. And for me as a theologian, the question is always, you know, not only how do we get there, but how do we maintain this? What are some of the mechanisms that keep this system in place? And here I am worried that there is a theology off the market that basically justifies the way things are. And it's not just the way things are, but things are constantly getting worse. So we haven't seen the worst of it yet if things continue this way.
Well, and you see the tremendous claims being made about all that's done for charity in a very prosperous economy, which we obviously have. It's unequal in its distribution, but we are the gross national product, and all that goes with it is up. And the argument is that that will produce more charity. And I mean, that may be, in fact, dollar for dollar true, but it doesn't change the system.
Well, in charity, we talked about this in one of our earlier episodes, but I struggle with the concept of charity, although I'm grateful and thankful that in many situations that we have that. But, you know, for me, charity is like, number one, why in the wealthiest country in the world do we need charity? And number two, who really gets the feel good? To feel good, I call it the feel good, but with quotation marks. But who really? What is charity to me? One gets to feel really good about giving the bicycle at Christmas. But again, charity is a very delicate situation, because we are so wealthy. Why do we need charity in this country, which goes into our economics?
So if you look at that from a theological perspective, I think a lot of people simply assume that charity is the most faithful response. They somehow assume this is what the Bible demands, this is what their traditions demand. But if you read the Bible and if you read the Jesus stories, I'm not sure it's charity what's happening there. There's a lot of what we now call advocacy, you know, speaking out against the problems, against evil. There's a lot of challenging that which is actually, you know, devouring people's wealth and what's actually doing people in. Certainly in the Old Testament prophets, also in the Hebrew Bible, you see this kind of an approach. And then there is what I'm calling solidarity also, where in Jesus' case, you know, he's not coming at this from the outside, but he's one of the people, grows up as a construction worker, somebody who works in construction, most likely large Roman building projects at the time, where people experience all kinds of abuse. The sort of abuse that construction workers experience today in large projects often. And oftentimes even unemployment. So all of that goes into Jesus's own approach to poverty and need. And so you can see that there's a much deeper response than merely charity.
You just reminded me, we were together at one point, and we were with Rosemarie, your wife, and I had never heard this before, but when you talk about people working and not having adequate protection, remember that time we were together and these
workers?
You're
talking about the workers.
Yes.
Construction workers building on a major building in south side of Dallas.
This was a Dallas story, but it happens all over the country.
Right.
I'll tell you the Dallas story real quick again, because this is so telling. So you had these construction workers, mostly immigrants, and therefore, of course, you know, the companies oftentimes felt they could do whatever they wanted. And so in this case, you had construction workers working more than the allotted hours every day, more than 12 hours. Oftentimes not getting enough drinking water or any drinking water. not getting the health care if somebody was injured, not getting safety equipment. This is actually things that happened and that we dealt with in Texas. And you wonder who is speaking out against that about it. Oftentimes we saw the churches doing charity, but we didn't see the churches really siding with us. Now, the truth is there were several churches that did, and I think this is what you find in the Jesus movement. There's a large pool of religion, and then there's some that are awake, some that are actually doing the right thing. But this is what we're still working on. This is why we're ultimately saying that this is not just a little question on the margins, but this question of God versus mammon is a central question to the faith. It's a central question in this context of Jesus versus Caesar that we're talking about.
You mentioned also in your book, in the United States, there is this stated principle of the separation of church and state, and there is no comparable principle of the separation of church and economy. So talk about the results of that.
Well, the old principle of separating church and state grew out of a situation where either, you know, the church was determining what would happen in the state or the state was determining what would happen in the church. And those were not happy times in either way, you know. And so understanding that there are some lines that have to be drawn is important. But this is lacking when it comes to the question of economics. And so the way this then shows up in real life sometimes is that money determines what's happening in the church. There's not a firewall between moneyed interests and religion. And so very oftentimes you see this sort of at a local level in the church. It's the donors that determine what happens in a community. It's the donors that oftentimes determine what a pastor feels he or she can preach, what they can say, and also what they cannot say. And so from that angle, it's a real problem that we're not thinking about drawing some lines between religion and economics. And then, of course, you get the whole question of the gospel of prosperity that we talked about in the other session.
Right.
And all of a sudden, it looks like not only does money determine what happens in the world, money determines what happens in the church.
What happens in the pulpit.
Yes, that's
correct. Yeah, firsthand experience of that and some of my colleagues, clergy, often, you know, we might go somewhere, we might go on a pilgrimage, and I often wonder, why don't you speak of that from the pulpit, what you saw, what you experienced with passion? And then the response is, I don't want to lose my job. So when you said that, it just struck such a delicate nerve that our clergy are, it's almost like gagged. They can't really speak the true gospel of Jesus as one of justice because of economic reasons.
And so you don't want to blame the clergy or even
communities
for it. You have to see the causes. And then the interesting question becomes, what do we do about that?
Right.
How do we actually develop alternatives? And one way to do that in churches, I've often suggested this to church members worried about the issue, is organize. Because organized power, organized people can change things. And so if there's some money coming from one side, people that may not be able to donate as much can still organize and thereby make their own voices heard. And by doing so, they would actually do their pastors a favor. Mm-hmm. They would do their...
If they showed that support.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
So this is something that would not be a hostile move. It wouldn't have to be sort of, you know, we're trying to run the show now. But it would create some alternatives that we right now don't have. And it's not just the pastors. It goes all the way to the theologians. It goes all the way to the church leadership. And so when I tongue-in-cheek talk about separation of church and economy, those are some of the issues I have in the back of my mind. And then vice versa, you know, too often theology simply justifying, rubber stamping whatever is happening in dominant economics. That's another problem.
So you also, David, did you want to say something about that?
Well, I do. I want to go back to my favorite word of the day here, malignant. the reason I like applying it to forms of the practice of faith is because it suggests not just death, but disease, that is something that is in the system that is causing sickness across the spectrum. And this whole way in which the powers that be economy can frustrate the best intentions of pastors and lay people in a church setting, it's like that's it. It feels like to me a disease that's out there that's kind of epidemic, and it touches so many churches and turns them into something besides what they are really meant to be. I just wanted to get that point in.
I think that's really crucial. And then rather than simply pointing it out, why we're here, what we're trying to do is figuring out what can we do about that?
What can we respond with?
And this is what I appreciate about the work that you're doing at the Dykes Foundation, not just pointing out some of our problems, but trying to find solutions. And ultimately, if we're not doing that work, I don't think we need to waste our time just looking at what's wrong. But we have to know what's wrong in order to figure out what we can do
right. We have to be willing to see what's wrong and say it to each other.
Yes.
And so let's talk about the work that we're doing. This idea you just expressed of what can be done, if people in a church knew that a group of people who give money to the church were saying to the pastor, if you take this action, this economic work or assistance, then we'll shut you down. How do you teach people to act collectively in a way that is resistant to that and gives pastors and other church leaders some kind of agency to stand up to these who are willing to cut funding if we dare cross certain lines?
That's a good question. One of the problems is that sometimes this is not even said explicitly, so it's not like money is constantly speaking and saying you have to do this. Money often functions in such a way that people discipline themselves before anything is said, so it becomes invisible that way. The thing then is you have to uncover some of these dependencies, and so the first thing really is seeing what's going on. And that then will help you determine some of the resistance. But some of that you find in the Gospels. Let me quickly mention the story in the Gospel of Matthew of the unforgiving servant. There's the old story of the master forgiving one of the servants an extreme amount of money, and then the servant going out into the street, and a fellow servant asks him to forgive a smaller amount of money, and he doesn't forgive, he has the person thrown in prison, and that's sort of the end of the story. And then the other servants come and they complain to the master and they say, well, this is horrible, and then that person gets punished also. Sort of in a nutshell, really mm-hmm. quickly, that is the mm-hmm. story. So your question is, how do we deal with a situation where, you know, money rules the world? Mm-hmm. I think this story shows something really important, because everybody somehow thinks this is about debt and money that's owed and so on. But if you look at it from the perspective of the servant, of the working person, you might figure out there is something more valuable at play here than money. Because at the moment when the servant whose debt has been forgiven meets the other servant, he has two options. One option is, I want to reclaim the debt. The other option is, I forgive the debt. But in forgiving the debt, I'm creating a relationship. I'm building some community power, because that person whose debt I have forgiven now becomes my ally, my friend. I'm in solidarity with that person. And so from a working class perspective, you could actually realize that what's important here is not the money. What's really important here is the solidarity. And so one way sort of to move beyond this domination of money is to say, what's really more important in your particular situation? And here you could actually teach the lesson that what counts is the solidarity between these working people. And if that servant had forgiven the other servant, they now would have a relationship. And if they forgive more servants down the road, you know, all of a sudden they have an even bigger relationship. They
well,
have
and
a
you
community.
Begin to change what I hear you speak of frequently, which is the power differential. That if all of a sudden you've got more and more people that are standing in deep solidarity together, now there's the potential of a shifting in the power base. Who, that is to
exactly.
say, who can make things happen.
Now imagine how you preach that parable next time, because the way it's usually preached is moralizing. Somebody forgave you, you must forgive too, even though you don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
You could now preach it differently and say, you've been forgiven. Now, if you're really smart, if you really pay attention to the interest of the community, we're going this way rather than that way. So it's not moralizing, you must do this, but think about it and you'll do the right thing, which is precisely to forgive each other. And, you know, if down the road the master changes his mind and starts writing on debt again, you know, saying, well, we have to have this sort of deal where we go back to the way it was, you now have a community that can resist it. So here there's all kinds of smart ways of dealing with money, relationships, wealth in the Gospels that we're missing if we're not paying attention to that dimension of our religious backgrounds and traditions.
Ooh, I think you have certainly given those who are going to be preaching from the pulpit at some time in the near future something to think about and hopefully share a different perspective on that particular parable. So we're going to bring this episode to a close. We have one more episode, and I think Anne's going to be back with us for the fifth episode. Our Faith and Reason 360 podcasts are free to all listeners. However, anyone who would like to make a donation, we certainly welcome any donation, whether it's a dollar or $5. I use that term. I could say $500,
well,
maybe even $5,000.
Yeah.
Anyway, it is tax deductible, and you can do so by visiting our website at faithandreason.org. faithandreason.org. And if you're interested, again, in purchasing this book we have been discussing over these past several episodes, Dr. Rieger's book is titled Jesus versus Caesar, for people tired of serving the wrong God. And it is available online at Amazon. Make sure that you look for Jesus versus Caesar by Jörg Rieger. And that is spelled J-O-E-R-G-R-I-E-G-E-R. I want to thank Dr. Rieger for being our guest again.
And thanks for having me.
You're quite welcome. I wish I could say that in German. But how do you say thank you? You're welcome in German.
Vielen Dank.
Oh, thank you. Vielen Dank.
Vielen Dank.
I didn't say it very well. And David, thank you, for hosting today. This program is produced by Faith and Reason, a program of the D.L. Dykes Jr. Foundation.
God chose Israel, remembering mercy, according to the promise to those he made before, to Sarah, to Abraham, to Hagar, to their children's children evermore.